astounding. I laughed out loud. I'm sure she was, Em. I'm sure she was. Don't worry about a thing, okay? You just concentrate on feeling better and I'll take care of everything else.
I'll email you a checklist just so you don't forget anything.
I won't forget anything. She's been in Europe 4 times in the past year. I've got it down. I'll get the cash from the basement bank, charge a few grand into euros, buy a few more grand's worth of traveler's checks, and triple confirm all of her hair and makeup appointments while she's there. What else? Oh, I'll make sure the Ritz gives her the right cell phone this time, and I'll speak to the drivers ahead of time to make sure they know they can't ever leave her waiting. I'm already thinking of all the people who need copies of her itinerary, which I'll type up, no problem, and I'll see to it that it gets passed around. And of course, she'll have a detailed itinerary as to the twins' classes, lessons, practices, and play dates, and full listings of the entire household staff's work schedules. See? You don't have to worry. I've got it all under control.
Don't forget about the velvet, she chided,
singing the last couple words as if on autopilot.
Or the scarves.
Of course not. They're already on my list. Before Miranda packed for anything, or rather had her housekeeper pack her, either Emily or I would purchase massive rolls of velvet at a fabric store and bring them to Miranda's apartment. There, we'd work with the housekeeper to cut them in the exact shape and size of every article of clothing she was planning to bring, and individually wrap each item in the plush material. The velvet packages were then neatly stacked in dozens of Louis Vuitton suitcases, with plenty of extra pieces included for when she inevitably threw the first batch out upon unpacking in Paris. In addition, usually one half of a suitcase was occupied by a couple dozen orange Hermes boxes, each containing a single white scarf, just waiting to be lost, forgotten, misplaced, or simply discarded. I hung up with Emily after making a good effort to sound sincerely sympathetic and found Lily stretched out on the couch, smoking a cigarette and sipping a clear liquid that was definitely not water from a cocktail glass. I thought we weren't allowed to smoke in here, I said, flopping down next to her and immediately putting my feet on the scuffed wooden coffee table my parents had handed down to us. Not that I care, but that was your rule. Lily wasn't a full-time committed smoker like yours truly. She usually smoked only when she drank, and wasn't one to even buy packs. A brand new box of Camel Special Lights peeked out of the chest pocket of her oversized button-down. I nudged her thigh with my slippered foot and nodded toward the cigarettes. She handed them over with a lighter.
I knew you wouldn't care, she said, taking a leisurely drag off her cigarette. I'm procrastinating, and it helps me concentrate.
What do you have due? I asked, lighting my own cigarette and tossing back the lighter. She was taking 17 credits this semester in an effort to pull up her GPA after last spring's mediocre showing. I watched as she took another drag and washed it down with a healthy gulp of her non-water beverage. It didn't appear that she was on the right track. She sighed heavily, meaningfully, and let the cigarette hang suspended from the corner of her mouth as she spoke. It flapped up and down, threatening to fall at any moment, and, combined with her wild, unwashed hair and smeared eye makeup, made her look, just for a moment, like a defendant on Judge Judy. Or maybe a plaintiff, since they always looked the same. Lack of teeth, greasy hair, dull eyes, and propensity for using the double negative.
An article for some totally random, esoteric academic journal that no one will ever read, but I still have to write just so I can say I'm published.
That's annoying. When is it due?
Tomorrow.
Total nonchalance. She looked completely unfazed. Tomorrow? For real? She shot me a warning look, a quick reminder that I was supposed to be on her team.
Yes, tomorrow. It really blows. Considering that Freudian boy is the one who's assigned to edit it, no one seems to care that he's a candidate in psych, not Russian lit. They're just short copy editors, so he's mine. There's no way I'm getting that to him on time. Screw him.
Once again, she poured some of the liquid down her throat, making an obvious effort not to taste it, and grimaced.
Lil, what happened? Granted, it's been a few months, but last I heard you were taking things slow and he was perfect. Of course, that was before that thing you dragged home, but... Another warning look, this time followed by a glare. I tried to talk to her about the whole freak boy incident a few dozen times, but it seemed like we were really never alone, and neither of us had much time lately for heart-to-hearts. She immediately changed the subject whenever I brought it up. I could tell that, more than anything, she was embarrassed. She had acknowledged that he was vile, but she wouldn't participate in any discussion whatsoever about the excessive drinking that was responsible for the whole episode. Yes, well, apparently at some point that night I called him from Obar and begged him to come meet me, she said, avoiding eye contact, instead concentrating intently on using the remote control to switch tracks on the mournful Jeff Buckley CD that seemed to be on permanent replay in the apartment. So? Did he come and see you talking to someone else? I was trying not to push her away even more by being critical of her. There was obviously a lot going on inside her head, what with the problems at school and the drinking and the seemingly limitless supply of guys, and I wanted her to open up to someone. She'd never kept anything from me before, if for no other reason that I was all she had. But she hadn't been telling me much of anything lately. It occurred to me how strange it was that we hadn't bothered to discuss this until 4 months after the fact. No, not quite, she said bitterly. He came all the way there from Morningside Heights, only to find me not there. Apparently he called my cell phone, and Kenny answered, and wasn't all that nice. Kenny? That thing I dragged home at the beginning of the summer, remember? She said it sarcastically, but this time she smiled. Aha, and I'm guessing Freudian boy didn't take that well? Not so much. Whatever, easy come, easy go, right? She scampered off to the kitchen with her empty glass, and I saw her pour from a half bottle full of Kettle One. A very small splash of soda, and she was back on the couch. I was just about to inquire as gently as possible why she was inhaling vodka when she had an article due the next day, but the buzzer rang from downstairs. Who's there? I called to John by holding down the button.
Mr. Feynman is here to see Ms. Sachs,
he announced formally, all business now that other people were around. Really? Great. Send him up. Lil looked at me and raised her eyebrows, and I realized that once again we weren't going to have this conversation.
You look psyched, she said with obvious sarcasm. Not exactly thrilled that your boyfriend is surprising you, are you?
Of course I am, I said defensively, and we both knew I was lying. Things with Alex had been strained the past few weeks. Really strained. We went through all the motions of being together, and we did it well. After almost 4 years, we certainly knew what the other wanted to hear or needed to do. But he'd compensated for all the time I spent at work by being even more angelic at school, volunteering to coach, tutor, mentor, and chair just about every activity someone could think up. And the time we did actually see each other was about as exciting as if we'd been married for 30 years. We had an unspoken understanding that we'd just wait things out until my year of servitude was over, but I wouldn't let myself think about where the relationship might be headed then. But still, that made two close people in my life, first Jill, who'd called me out on the miserable state of affairs on the phone the other night, and now Lily, who'd pointed out that Alex and I were less than adorable together lately, and I had to admit that Lily had, in her buzzed but nonetheless perceptive way, noticed that I was not happy to hear that Alex had arrived. I was dreading telling him that I had to go to Europe, dreading the inevitable fight that would ensue, a fight I very much would have liked to put off for a few more days. Ideally, not until I was in Europe. But no such luck, as he was currently knocking on my door. Hi, I said a bit too enthusiastically as I pulled open the door and threw my arms around his neck. What a great surprise.
You don't mind that I just stopped by, do you? I met Max for a drink right around the corner and I thought I'd say hi. Of course I don't mind, silly. I'm thrilled. Come in, come in.
I knew I sounded positively manic, but my armchair shrink could easily point out that my outward enthusiasm was meant to overcompensate for all that was lacking inwardly. He grabbed a beer and kissed Lily on the cheek and settled into the bright orange armchair my parents had saved from the 70s, just knowing that one day they could bestow it proudly on one of their offspring.
So, what's going on here?
He asked, nodding toward the stereo, where a positively heart-wrenching version of Hallelujah was blaring. Lily shrugged.
Procrastinating. What else?
Well, I have some news, I said, trying to sound enthusiastic to convince both myself and Alex that this was, in fact, a positive development. He'd been so excited about arranging all the plans for our homecoming weekend, and I'd been so pushy in getting him to do it, that it seemed downright cruel to be canceling on him less than a week and a half before we were going. We'd spent an entire night figuring out whom we wanted to invite to our big Sunday brunch, and even knew exactly where and with whom we'd be tailgating before the Brown-Dartmouth game on Saturday. They both looked at me, not a little warily, until Alex finally managed.
Yeah? What's up?
Well, I just got the call. I'm going to Paris for a week.
I said this with the exuberance of telling an infertile couple that they were having twins.
You're going where?
Lily asked, looking puzzled and distracted, not entirely interested.
You're going why?
Alex asked at the same exact moment, looking about as pleased as if I'd just announced that I had tested positive for syphilis.
Emily just found out she has mono, and Miranda wants me to accompany her to the shows. Isn't that awesome?
I said, a chipper smile on my face. This was exhausting. I was dreading having to go myself, but it made it 10 times worse to have to convince him that it was actually a really great opportunity.
I don't understand. Doesn't she go to the shows like 1,000 times a year?
He asked. I nodded.
So why does she all of a sudden need you to go with her now?
Lily had tuned out at this point and seemed to be engrossed in flipping through an old issue of The New Yorker. I'd saved every copy from the past 5 years.
She throws this massive party at the spring shows in Paris, and just likes to have one of her American assistants be there. She'll go to Milan first, and then we'll meet in Paris to, you know, oversee everything.
And that American assistant has to be you. And it has to mean you'll be missing homecoming. He said flatly.
Well, it's not normally the way it works. Since it's considered a huge privilege, usually the senior assistant is the only one who gets to go, but since Emily is sick, then, yes, now I will be going. I have to leave next Tuesday, so I can't go to Providence that weekend. I'm really, really sorry.
I moved off my chair and went to sit closer to him on the couch, but he immediately stiffened.
So it's just that simple, right? You know, I already paid for the entire room to guarantee the rate. Never mind the fact that I rearranged my whole schedule to go with you that weekend. I told my mom she had to find a sitter because you wanted to go. Not a big deal, though, right? Just another runway obligation.
In all the years we'd spent together, I'd never seen him so angry. Even Lily looked up from her magazine long enough to excuse herself and get the hell out of the room before this turned into an all-out war. I tried to curl up on his lap, but he crossed his legs and waved his hand.
Seriously, Andrea?
He called me that only when he was really annoyed.
Is all of this really worth it? Be honest with me for a second. Is it worth it to you?
All of what? Is missing a homecoming weekend when there will be dozens more worth it to do something I'm required to do for my job? A job that is going to open doors for me I never thought possible, and sooner than I ever expected? Yes, it's worth it.
His chin dropped to his chest, and for a moment I thought he was crying. But when he lifted it again, his face revealed nothing but rage.
Don't you think I'd rather go with you than go be someone's slave 24/7 for a straight week?
I shouted, forgetting entirely that Lily was somewhere in the apartment.
Can't you stop for 1 second to think about the fact that I may not want to go either, but I have no choice?
No choice. You have nothing but choices. Andy, this job isn't just a job anymore, in case you've failed to notice. It's taken over your entire life, he yelled back, the redness in his face expanding to his neck and ears. Normally, I thought this was very cute, even sexy. But tonight, I just wanted to go to sleep.
Alex, listen. I know.
No, you listen. Forget about me for a second. Not like that's such a stretch. But forget that we never, ever see each other anymore because of the hours you keep at work, because of your never-ending work emergencies. What about your parents? When was the last time you actually saw them? And your sister? You do realize that she just had her first baby and you haven't even seen your own nephew yet, don't you? Doesn't that mean anything?
He lowered his voice and leaned in closer. I thought he might be getting ready to apologize, but he said,
What about Lily? Have you noticed that your best friend has turned into a raging alcoholic?
I must have looked absolutely shocked because he barreled on.
You can't even think of saying you didn't realize that, Andy. It's the most obvious thing in the world.
Yes, of course she drinks. So do you, and so do I, and so does everyone we know. Lily's a student, and that's what students do, Alex. What's so weird about that?
It sounded even more pathetic when I said it out loud, and he only shook his head. We were both quiet for a few minutes until he spoke.
You just don't get it, Andy. I'm not exactly sure how it happened, but I feel like I don't even know you anymore. I think we need a break.
What? What are you saying? You want to break up?
I asked, realizing much too late that he was very, very serious. Alex was so understanding, so sweet, so available that I'd begun to take for granted that he'd always be around to listen or talk me down after a long day or cheer me up when everyone else had felt free to take a swing. The only problem with all of this was that I wasn't exactly holding up my end of the deal.
No, not at all. Not break up, just take a break. I think it would help both of us to reevaluate what we've got going here. You sure don't seem happy with me lately, and I can't say I'm thrilled with you. Maybe a little time away would be good for both of us.
Good for both of us? You think it'll help us?
I wanted to scream at the triteness of his words, at the idea that taking some time would actually help draw us closer. It seemed selfish that he was doing this now, just as I was going into what I hoped was the last of my one-year runway sentence, and mere days before I had to pull off the biggest challenge of my career. Any quick jabs of sadness or concern from a few minutes ago had been swiftly replaced with irritation.
Fine, then. Let's take a break, I said sarcastically, meanly. A breather. Sounds like a great plan.
He stared at me with those big brown eyes, with a look of overwhelming surprise and hurt, and then pressed them tightly shut in an apparent effort to push away the image of my face.
Okay, Andy. I'll put you out of your obvious misery and leave now. I hope you have a great time in Paris. I really do. I'll talk to you soon.
And before I even realized that it was actually happening, he kissed me on the cheek like he would Lily or my mother and walked toward the door.
Alex, don't you think we should talk about this?
I said, trying to keep my voice calm, wondering if he would actually walk out right now. He turned and smiled sadly and said,
Let's not talk about any more tonight, Andy. We should have been talking the past few months, the past year, not trying to cram it all in right now. Think about everything, okay? I'll call you in a couple weeks when you're back and settled. And good luck in Paris. I know you'll be great.
He opened the door, stepped through it, and quietly closed it behind him. I ran to Lily's room so she could tell me that he was overreacting, that I had to go to Paris because it was the best thing for my future, that she didn't have a drinking problem, that I wasn't a bad sister for leaving the country when Jill had just had her first baby. But she was passed out on top of her covers, fully dressed, the empty cocktail glass on her bedside table. Her Toshiba laptop was open beside her on the bed, and I wondered if she'd managed to write a single word. I looked.
Bravo. She'd written the heading, complete with her name, the class number, the professor's name, and her presumably temporary version of the article's title. The Psychological Ramifications of Falling in Love with Your Reader. I laughed out loud, but she didn't stir, so I moved the computer back to her desk and set her alarm for 7 and turned out the lights. My cell phone rang as soon as I walked in my bedroom. After the initial 5-second usual heart-pounding session I endured each time it rang for fear that it was her, I flipped it open immediately, knowing it was Alex. I knew he couldn't leave things so unfinished. This was the same guy who couldn't fall asleep without a goodnight kiss and a verbal wish for sweet dreams. There was no way he was just prancing out of here, totally fine with the suggestion that we not talk for a few weeks.
"Hi, baby,"
I breathed, missing him already, but still happy to be on the phone with him and not necessarily having to deal with everything in person right now. My head ached and my shoulders felt like they were glued to my ears, and I just wanted to hear him say that the whole thing had been a big mistake and he'd call me tomorrow.
"I'm glad you called."
"Baby, wow. We're making progress, aren't we, Andy? Better be careful or I might have to consider the possibility that you want me," Christian said smoothly, with a grin I could hear over the phone line. "I'm glad I called, too."
"Oh, it's you."
"Well, that's not the warmest welcome I've ever received. What's the matter, Andy? You've been screening me lately, haven't you?"
"Of course not," I lied. "I've just had a bad day, as usual. What's up?"
He laughed. "Andy, Andy, Andy, come on now. You have no reason to be so unhappy. You're on the fast track to great things. Speaking of which, I'm calling to see if you wanted to come to a pen award ceremony and reading tomorrow night. Should be lots of interesting people, and I haven't seen you in a while. Purely professional, of course."
For a girl who had read way too many How to Know If He's Ready to Commit articles in Cosmo, one might think the warning flags would have gone up on this one. And they did. I just chose to ignore them. It had been a very long day, and so I allowed myself to think, just for a few minutes, that he might actually be sincere. Screw it. It felt good to talk to a non-critical male for a few minutes, even if he did refuse to accept that I was taken. I knew I wouldn't actually accept his invitation, but a few minutes of innocent phone flirting wouldn't hurt anyone.
"Oh, really?" I asked coyly. "Tell me about it."
"I'm gonna list all the reasons that you should come with me, Andy, and the first one is the simplest. I know it's good for you, period."
God, he was arrogant. Why did I find it so endearing?
Game on. We were off and running, and it took only a few more minutes until the trip to Paris and Lily's nasty little vodka habit and Alex's sad eyes faded to the background of my acknowledged unhealthy and emotionally dangerous but really sexy and fun nonetheless conversation with Christian. Chapter 16. It was planned that Miranda would be in Europe for a week before I was due to arrive. She settled for using some local assistance for the Milan shows and would be arriving in Paris the same morning I was, so we'd work out the details of her party together. Like old friends. Huh. Delta had refused to simply change the name on the ticket from Emily's to mine, so rather than get even more frustrated and hassled than I already was, I just charged a new one. $2,200 because it was Fashion Week, and I was buying at the last minute. I paused for one ridiculous minute before forking over the corporate card number. Whatever, I thought. Miranda can spend that in a week on hair and makeup alone. As Miranda's junior assistant, I was the lowest-ranking human being at Runway. However, if access is power, then Emily and I were the two most powerful people in fashion. We determined who got meetings, when they were scheduled. Early morning was always preferred because people's makeup would be fresh and their clothes unwrinkled, and whose messages got through. If your name wasn't on the bulletin, you didn't exist. So when either of us needed help, the rest of the staff were obliged to pull through. Yes, of course, there was something disconcerting about the realization that if we didn't work for Miranda Priestley, these same people would have no compunction in running over us with their chauffeured town cars. As it was, when called upon, They ran and fetched and retrieved for us like well-trained puppies. Work on the current issue ground to a halt as everyone rallied to send me off to Paris adequately prepared. Three clackers from the fashion department hastily pulled together a wardrobe that included every single item that I could conceivably require for any event Miranda could conceivably call on me to attend. By the time I left, Lucia, the fashion director, promised I would have in my possession not only an assemblage of clothing appropriate for any contingency, but also a full sketchbook complete with professionally rendered charcoal sketches depicting every imaginable way of preparing the aforementioned clothing in order to maximize style and minimize embarrassment. In other words, leave nothing to my own selection or pairing, and I'd quite possibly have a shot in hell, albeit slim, of looking presentable. Might I need to accompany Miranda to a bistro and stand, mummy-like, in the corner while she sipped a glass of Bordeaux? A pair of cuffed charcoal-gray theory pants with a black silk turtleneck sweater by Celine. Attend the tennis club where she'd received her private lessons so that I could fetch water and, if required, white scarves in case she schwitzed? Head-to-toe athletic outfit complete with bootleg workout pants, zip-up hooded jacket, cropped to show off my tummy natch, a $185 wife beater to wear under it, and suede sneakers, all by Prada. And what if maybe, just maybe, I actually did make it to the front row of one of those shows like everyone swore I would? The options were limitless. My favorite so far, and it was still only late afternoon on Monday, was a pleated schoolgirl skirt by Anna Sui with a very sheer and very frilly white Mimi blouse, paired with a particularly naughty-looking pair of mid-calf Christian Louboutin boots, and topped with a Catayuna Adele leather blazer so fitted it bordered on obscene. My express jeans and Franco Sarto loafers had been buried in a film of dust in my closet for months now, and I had to admit, I didn't miss them. I also discovered that Allison, the beauty editor, did, in fact, deserve her title by literally being the beauty industry. Within 24 hours of being put on notice that I would be needing some makeup and more than a few tips, she had created the be-all, end-all cosmetic catch-all. Included in the decidedly oversized Burberry toiletry case, it actually more closely resembled a wheeled suitcase slightly larger than those approved by the airlines for carry-on, was every imaginable type of shadow, lotion, gloss, cream, liner, and type of makeup. Lipsticks came in matte, high shine, long-lasting, and clear. Six shades of mascara, ranging in color from a light blue to a pouty black, were accompanied by an eyelash curler and two eyelash combs in case of, gasp, clumps. Powders, which appeared to account for half of all the products and fixed/accentuated/hid the eyelids, the skin tone, and the cheeks, had a color scheme more complex and subtler than a painter's palette. Some were meant to bronze, others to highlight, and still others to pout, plump, or pale. I had the choice whether to add that healthy blush to my face in the form of a liquid, solid, powder, or a combination thereof. The foundation was the most impressive of all. It was as if someone had managed to remove an actual sample of skin directly from my face and custom mix a pint or two of the stuff. Whether it added sheen or covered blemishes, every single solitary little bottle matched my skin tone better than, well, my own skin. Packed in a slightly smaller matching plaid case were the supplies. Cotton balls, cotton squares, Q-tips, sponges, somewhere in the vicinity of 24 different size application brushes, washcloths, 2 different types of eye makeup remover, moisturizing and oil-free, and no less than 12 kinds of moisturizer. Facial, body, deep conditioning, with SPF 15, glimmering, tinted, scented, non-scented, hypoallergenic, with alpha hydroxy, antibacterial, and just in case that nasty October Parisian sun got the best of me, with aloe vera. Tucked in a side pocket of the smaller case were legal-sized pieces of paper with pre-printed faces rendered on each one, enlarged to fit the page.
Each face bragged an impressive makeover. Allison had applied the actual makeup she'd included in the kit to the paper faces. One face was eerily labeled Relaxing Evening Glamour, but had a caveat under it in big, bold marker that read, Not for black tie, too casual. The non-formal face had a light covering of the matte foundation under a slight brush of bronzing powder, a light dab of liquid or creme blush, some very sexy, dark-lined and heavily shadowed eyelids, accented by jet-black mascara lashes, and what appeared to be a quick, casual swipe of high-gloss lip color. When I'd mumbled under my breath to Allison that this would be utterly impossible for me to recreate, she looked exasperated. Well, hopefully you won't have to, she said in a voice that sounded so taxed I thought she might collapse under the weight of my ignorance. No? Then why do I have nearly 24 faces suggesting different ways to use all this stuff? Her withering glance was worthy of Miranda. Andrea, be serious. This is for emergencies only in case Miranda asks you to go somewhere with her at the last minute or if your hair and makeup person can't make it. Oh, that reminds me. Let me show you the hair stuff I packed. As Allison demonstrated how to use 4 different types of round brushes to blow my hair straight, I tried to make sense of what she just said. I would have a hair and makeup person too? I hadn't arranged for anyone to do me when I booked all of Miranda's people, so who had? I had to ask. The Paris office, Allison replied with a sigh. You're representing runway, you know, and Miranda is very sensitive to that. You'll be attending some of the most glamorous events in the world alongside Miranda Priestly. You don't think you could achieve the right look on your own, do you? No, of course not. It's definitely better that I have professional help for this. Thank you. Then Allison kept me cornered an additional 2 hours until she was satisfied that if any of the 14 hair and makeup appointments I had scheduled over the course of the week fell through, I wouldn't humiliate our boss by smearing the mascara across my lips or shaving the sides of my head and spiking the center into a mohawk. When we were through, I thought I'd finally get a moment to race down to the dining room and grab some calorie-enriched soup, but Allison picked up Emily's extension, her old phone line, and dialed Steph in the accessories department. Hi, I'm done with her and she's here right now. You want to come over? Wait, I need to get lunch before Miranda comes back. Allison rolled her eyes just like Emily. I wondered if it was something about that particular position that inspired such expert demonstrations of irritation. Fine. No, I was talking to Andrea, she said into the phone, raising her eyebrows at me. Surprise, surprise, just like Emily. It seems that she's hungry. I know, yes, I know. I told her that, but she seems intent on eating. I walked out of the office and picked up a large cup of cream of broccoli with cheddar cheese and returned within 3 minutes to find Miranda sitting at her desk, holding the phone receiver away from her face like it was covered in leeches. She was due to fly to Milan that very evening, but I wasn't sure I'd survive to see it happen. The phone rings, Andrea, but when I pick it up, because you're apparently not interested in doing so, no one's there. Can you explain this phenomenon? She asked. Of course I could explain it, just not to her. On the rare occasion that Miranda was in her office alone, she sometimes picked up the phone when it rang. Naturally, callers were so shocked to hear her voice on the other end that they promptly hung up. No one was actually prepared to speak with her when they called, since the likelihood of being put through was next to nil. I'd gotten dozens of emails from editors or assistants informing me, as if I didn't know, that Miranda was answering the phone again. "Where are you guys?" the panicked missives would read one after another. "She's answering her own phone!" I mumbled something about how I, too, received hang-ups every now and then, but Miranda had already lost interest. She was peering not at me, but at my cup of soup. Some of the creamy green fluid was dripping slowly down the side. Her gaze turned to one of disgust when she realized I was not only holding something edible, but that I had clearly planned to consume it as well. "Dispose of that immediately," she barked from 15 feet away.
The smell of it alone is enough to make me ill.
I dropped the offending soup in the garbage can and gazed wistfully at the lost nourishment before her voice jerked me back to reality.
I'm ready for the run-throughs, she screeched, settling back into her chair more easily now that the food she'd spotted at Runway had been discarded. And the moment we're through here, call the features meeting.
Each word caused another adrenaline surge. Since I was never sure what exactly she'd be requesting, I was never sure if I'd be able to handle it or not. Since it was Emily's job to schedule the run-throughs and the weekly meetings, I had to race over to her desk and check her appointment book. In the 3 o'clock slot, she had scribbled, Sedona shoot run-through, Lucia Helen. I jabbed Lucia's extension and spoke as soon as she picked up the phone.
She's ready, I stated, like a military commander.
Helen, Lucia's assistant, hung up without saying a word, and I knew she and Lucia were already halfway to the office. If they didn't arrive within 20 to 25 seconds, I would be sent out to hunt them down and remind them in person, just in case they might have forgotten, that when I'd called 30 seconds before and said that Miranda was ready right then, I meant right then. Generally, this was a mere annoyance, yet another reason why the enforced footwear of spiky stilettos made life even more miserable. Running through the office, frantically searching for someone who was most likely hiding from Miranda, was never fun. But it was only really miserable when that person happened to be in the bathroom. Whatever one does in the men's or ladies' room, however, is no excuse for not being available at the exact moment your presence is expected. And so I had to charge right in, sometimes checking underneath the stalls for recognizable footwear, and politely ask, in whatever humiliated way I could manage, that they finish up and head to Miranda's office. Immediately. Luckily for everyone involved, Helen arrived within seconds, pushing an overflowing off-kilter wheeled rack in front of her and pulling another behind her. She hesitated briefly outside Miranda's French door before she received one of Miranda's imperceptible nods and then dragged the racks through the thick carpeting.
"This is all of it, 2 racks?" Miranda asked, barely looking up from the copy she was reading.
Helen was clearly surprised at being addressed, since, as a rule, Miranda didn't speak to other people's assistants. But Lucia hadn't shown up with her own racks yet, so there was little choice.
No, Lucia will be here in just a minute. She has the other two. Would you like me to, begin showing you what we've called in?"
Helen asked nervously as she pulled her ribbed tank top down over her prairie skirt.
"No."
And then,
"Andrea, find Lucia. By my watch it's 3 o'clock. If she's not prepared, then I have better things to do than sit here and wait for her."
Which wasn't exactly true, since it appeared she hadn't yet stopped reading copy, and it was now only approximately 35 seconds since I'd made the initial phone call, but I wasn't about to point this out.
"No need, Miranda, I'm right here,"
sang a breathless Lucia, herself pushing and pulling racks past me just as I stood to begin the search.
"So sorry, we were waiting for one last coat from the YSL people."
She arranged the racks, which were organized by clothing type, shirts, outerwear, pants slash skirts and dresses, in a half circle in front of Miranda's desk, and gave the signal for Helen to leave. Miranda and Lucia then went through each item one by one and bickered over its place, or lack thereof, in the upcoming fashion shoot that was to take place in Sedona, Arizona. Lucia was pushing for an urban cowgirl chic look, which she thought would play out perfectly against a backdrop of the Red Rock Mountains, but Miranda kept announcing, snidely, that she'd prefer just chic, since cowgirl chic was clearly an oxymoron. Maybe she'd had her fill of cowgirl chic at B-Dad's brother's party. I managed to tune them out until Miranda called my name, this time ordering me to call in the accessories people for their run-through. Immediately, I checked Emily's book again, but it was just as I thought. There was no accessories run-through scheduled. Praying that Emily had simply forgotten to put it in the book, I called Steph and told her Miranda was ready for the Sedona run-through. No such luck. They weren't scheduled for their run-through until late afternoon the following day, and at least a quarter of the things they needed hadn't been delivered yet from their PR companies.
"Impossible. Can't do it."
announced Steph, sounding much less confident than her words implied.
Well, what the hell do you expect me to tell her? I whispered back.
Tell her the truth. The run-through wasn't supposed to take place until tomorrow, and a lot of the stuff isn't here. I mean, seriously. Right now, we're still waiting for one evening bag, one clutch, 3 different fringed purses, 4 pairs of shoes, 2 necklaces, 3...
Okay, okay, I'll tell her. But wait by the phone and pick it up if I call you back. And if I were you, I'd get ready. I'm betting she doesn't really care when it was scheduled for.
Steph hung up on me without another word, and I approached Miranda's doors and waited patiently for her to acknowledge me. When she looked in my general direction and waited, I said,
Miranda, I just spoke to Steph, and she said that since the run-through wasn't scheduled until tomorrow, they're still waiting for quite a few items, but they should all be here by...
Andrea, I simply cannot visualize how these models will look in their clothes without shoes or bags or jewelry, and by tomorrow, I'll be in Italy. Tell Steph I want her to give me a run-through of whatever she's got and be prepared to show me photos of whatever isn't here yet.
She turned back to Lucia, and together they returned to the racks. Conveying this to Steph gave new meaning to, don't shoot the messenger. She freaked.
I cannot fucking pull a run-through together in 30 seconds, do you understand me? It's fucking impossible. 4 of my 5 assistants aren't here, and the only one who is here is a complete fucking idiot. Andrea, what the fuck am I gonna do?
She was hysterical, but there wasn't much room for negotiation.
Okay, great then, I said sweetly, eyeing Miranda, who had a knack of hearing everything. I'll tell Miranda you'll be right here.
I hung up before she dissolved into tears. I wasn't surprised to see Steph arrive 2.5 minutes later with her one fucking idiot accessories assistant, a fashion assistant she'd borrowed, and James, also borrowed from Beauty, all looking terrified as they carried oversized wicker baskets. They stood cowering by my desk until Miranda gave another imperceptible nod, at which point they all shuffled forward for the genuflection exercises. Since Miranda obviously refused to leave her office, ever, she required that all the overflowing racks of clothes and carts full of shoes and baskets brimming over with accessories must be schlepped to her. When the accessories people finally managed to lay out their wares in neat rows on the carpet for her to inspect, Miranda's office morphed into a Bedouin bazaar, one that just so happens to look more like Madison Avenue than Sharm el-Sheikh. One editor was presenting her with $2,000 snakeskin belts, while another tried to sell her a large Kelly bag. A third hawked a short Fendi cocktail dress, while someone else tried to sell her on the merits of chiffon. Steph had managed to assemble a near-perfect run-through with only 30 seconds' notice and a whole lot of pieces missing. I saw she had filled the gaps with things from past photo shoots, explaining to Miranda that the accessories they were still waiting for were similar, but even better. They were all masters of what they do, but Miranda was the ultimate. She was the ever-aloof consumer, coolly moving from one gorgeous stall to the next, never feigning any show of interest. When she finally, blessedly, did decide, she pointed and commanded, much like a judge at a dog show. Bob, she'd chosen the border collie. And the editors nodded obsequiously. Yes, excellent choice. Oh, definitely the perfect choice. And they wrapped up their wares and scuttled back to their respective departments before she inevitably changed her mind. The whole hellish ordeal only took a few minutes, but by the time it was over, we were all exhausted from anxiety. She'd already announced earlier in the day that she'd be leaving early, around 4, to spend a couple hours with the girls before the big trip, so I canceled the features meeting, to the relief of the entire department. At precisely 3:58 p.m., she began packing her bag to leave, a not-so-strenuous activity since I'd be bringing anything of any heft or significance to her apartment later on that evening in time for her flight. Basically, it involved tossing her Gucci wallet and her Motorola cell phone into that Fendi bag she kept abusing. The past few weeks, the $10,000 beauty had been serving as Cassidy's school bag, and many of the beads, in addition to one of the handles, had snapped off. Miranda had dropped it on my desk one day and ordered me to have it fixed, or, if it was impossible to fix, to just throw out. I'd proudly resisted all temptation to tell her the bag was unfixable so I could keep it,
and instead had a leather worker repair it for her for a mere $25. When she finally walked out, I instinctively reached for the phone to call Alex and whine about my day. It wasn't until I dialed half of his number that I remembered we were taking a break. It hit me that this would be the first day in more than 3 years that we wouldn't talk. I sat with the phone in my hand, staring at an email he'd sent the day before, one that he'd signed Love, and wondered if I'd made a horrible mistake in agreeing to this break. I dialed again, this time ready to tell him that we should talk about everything, figure out where we'd gone wrong, that I take responsibility for the part I'd played in the slow and steady fading of our relationship. But before it even had a chance to ring, Steph was standing over my desk with the accessories war plan for my Paris trip, pumped up from her run-through with Miranda. There were shoes and bags and belts and jewelry and hosiery and sunglasses to discuss, so I replaced the receiver and tried to focus on her instructions. Logically, it would seem that a 7-hour flight in steerage decked out in a pair of skin-tight leather pants, open-toe strappy sandals, and a blazer over a tank top would be the utmost in hellish travel experiences. Not so. The 7 hours in flight were the most relaxing I could remember. Since Miranda and I were both flying to Paris at the same time on different flights, she from Milan and me from New York, it appeared I'd stumbled on the single situation where she could not call me for 7 straight hours. For one blessed day, my inaccessibility wasn't my fault. For reasons I still didn't understand, my parents hadn't been nearly as thrilled as I thought they'd be when I called to tell them about the trip. "Oh, really?" my mother asked, in that special way of hers that implied so much more than those two little words really meant. "You're going to Paris now." "What do you mean now?" "Well, it just doesn't seem like the best time to be jetting off to Europe is all," she said vaguely, although I could tell that an avalanche of Jewish mother guilt was ready to begin its slide in my direction. "And why is that? When would be a good time?"
"Don't get upset, Andy. It's just that we haven't seen you in months, not that we're complaining. Dad and I both understand how demanding your job is. But don't you want to see your new nephew? He's a few months old already, and you haven't even met him yet."
"Mom, don't make me feel guilty. I'm dying to see Isaac, but you know I can't just..."
"You know Dad and I'll pay for your ticket to Houston, right?"
"Yes, you've told me 400 times. I know it and I appreciate it, but it's not the money. I can't get any time off work, and now with Emily out, I can't just up and leave, even on weekends. Does it make sense to you to fly across the country only to have to come back if Miranda calls me on Saturday morning to pick up her dry cleaning? Does it?"
"Of course not, Andy. We just thought that you might be able to visit them in the next couple weeks because Miranda was going to be away and all. And if you were going to fly out there, then Dad and I would go also. But now you're going to Paris."
She said it in the way that implied what she was really thinking. "But now you're going to Paris" translated to, "but now you're jetting off to Europe to escape all of your family obligations."
"Mother, let me make something very, very clear here. I am not going on vacation. I have not chosen to go to Paris rather than meet my baby nephew. It's not my decision at all, as you probably know, but are refusing to accept. It's really very simple. I go to Paris with Miranda in 3 days for 1 week, or I get fired. Do you see a choice here? Because if so, I'd love to hear it."
She was quiet for a moment before she said,
"No, of course not, honey. You know we understand. I just hope that you're happy with the way things are going."
"What's that supposed to mean?" I asked nastily.
"Nothing, nothing," she rushed to say. "It doesn't mean anything other than just what I said. Your dad and I only care that you're happy, and it seems that you've really been, pushing yourself lately. Is everything okay?"
I softened a bit since she was clearly trying so hard. Yeah, Mom. Everything's fine. I'm not happy to be going to Paris, just so you know. It's going to be a week of sheer hell, 24/7. But my year will be up soon, and I can put this kind of living behind me.
I know, sweetie. I know it's been a tough year for you. I just hope this all ends up being worth it for you. That's all.
I know. So do I.
We hung up on good terms, but I couldn't shake the feeling that my own parents were disappointed in me. The baggage claim at De Gaulle was a nightmare, but I found the elegantly dressed driver who was waving a sign with my name on it when I exited customs, and the moment he closed his own door, he handed me a cell phone.
Miss Brisley asked that you call her upon arrival. I took the liberty of programming the hotel's number into the automatic dialing. She's in the Coco Chanel suite.
Oh, okay. Thanks. I guess I'll call her right now, I announced, rather unnecessarily. But before I could press the star key and the number one, the phone bleated and flashed a frightening red color. If the driver hadn't been watching me expectantly, I would have muted the ring and pretended I hadn't yet seen it, but I was left with the distinct feeling that he had been ordered to keep a close eye on me. Something about his expression suggested that it was not in my best interest to ignore that call.
Hello, this is Andrea Sachs, I said as professionally as possible, already making over/under bets with myself as to the chance it was anyone besides Miranda.
Andrea, what time does your watch read at this moment?
Was this a trick question, a preface to accusing me of being late?
Let me see. Actually, it says that it's 5:15 in the morning, but obviously I haven't switched it yet to Paris time. Therefore, my watch should read that it's 11:15 a.m., I said cheerily, hoping to start off the first conversation of our interminable trip on as high a note as I dared.
Thank you for that never-ending narrative, Andrea. And may I ask what exactly you've been doing for the past 35 minutes?
Well, Miranda, the flight landed a few minutes late, and then I still had...
Because according to the itinerary you created for me, I'm reading that your flight arrived at 10:35 this morning.
Yes, that's when it was scheduled to arrive, but you see...
I'll not have you tell me what I see, Andrea. That is most certainly not acceptable behavior for the next week. Do you understand me?
Yes, of course. I'm sorry.
My heart began pounding what felt like a million beats a minute, and I could feel my face glow hot with humiliation. Humiliation at being spoken to that way, but more than anything, my own shame in pandering to it. I had just apologized, most sincerely, to someone for not being able to make my international flight land at the correct time, and then for not being savvy enough to figure out how to avoid French customs entirely. I pressed my face rather uncouthly against the window and watched as the limo weaved its way through Paris's bustling streets. The women seemed so much taller here, the men so much more genteel, and just about everyone was beautifully dressed, thin, and regal in their stance. I'd only been to Paris once before, but living out of a backpack in a hostel on the wrong side of town didn't quite have the same feel as watching the chic little clothing boutiques and adorable sidewalk cafes from the back seat of a limousine. I could get used to this, I thought, as the driver turned around to show me where I might find a few bottles of water if I was so inclined. When the car pulled up to the hotel entrance, a distinguished-looking gentleman, wearing what I guessed was a custom-made suit, opened the back door for me.
Mademoiselle Sachs, what a pleasure to finally meet you. I am Gérard Renault.
His voice was smooth and confident, and his silver hair and deeply lined face indicated he was much older than I'd pictured when I spoke to the concierge over the phone.
Monsieur Renault, it's great to finally meet you.
Suddenly, all I wanted to do was crawl into a nice soft bed and sleep off my jet lag, but Renault quickly quashed my hopes.
Mademoiselle Andrea, Madame Priestley would like to see you in her room immediately, before you've settled into yours, I'm afraid.
He had an apologetic expression on his face, and for a brief moment I felt sorrier for him than I did for myself. Clearly, he didn't enjoy conveying this news.
That's fucking great, I muttered, before noticing how distressed this made Monsieur Renaud. I plastered on a winning smile and began again.
Please, excuse me, it was a terribly long flight. Will someone please tell me where I may find Miranda?
Of course, mademoiselle. She is in her suite, and from what I can gather, very eager to see you.
When I looked over at Monsieur Renaud, I thought I detected a slight eye roll. And even though I'd always found him oppressively proper over the phone, I reconsidered. Although he was much too professional to show it, never mind actually say anything, I considered that he might loathe Miranda as much as I did. Not because of any real proof I had, but simply because it was impossible to imagine anyone not hating her. The elevator opened, and Monsieur Renaud smiled and ushered me inside. He said something in French to the bellman who was escorting me upstairs. Renaud bid me adieu, and the bellman led me to Miranda's suite. He knocked on the door and then fled, leaving me to face Miranda alone. I briefly wondered if Miranda herself would answer the door, but it was impossible to imagine. In the 11 months I'd been letting myself in and out of her apartment, I'd yet to catch her doing anything that even resembled work, including such pedestrian tasks as answering the phone, removing a jacket from a closet, or pouring a glass of water. It was as if her every day was Shabbat and she was once again the observant Jew, and I was, of course, her Shabbos goy. A pretty, uniformed maid opened the door and ushered me inside, her sad eyes moist and staring directly at the floor.
Andrea!
I heard from somewhere in the deep recesses of the most magnificent living room I'd ever seen.
Andrea, I'll need my Chanel suit pressed for tonight since it was practically ruined with wrinkles on the flight over. You'd think the Concorde would know how to handle luggage, but my things look dreadful. Also, call Horace Mann and confirm that the girls made it to school. You'll be doing that every day. I just don't trust that Annabelle. Make sure you speak with both Carolyn and Cassidy each night and write out a list of their homework assignments and upcoming exams. I'll expect a written report in the morning right before breakfast. Oh, and get Senator Schumer on the phone immediately. It's urgent. Lastly, I need you to contact that idiot Renaud and tell him I expect him to supply me with competent staff during my stay. And if that's too difficult, I'm sure the general manager would be able to assist me. That dumb girl he sent me is mentally challenged.
My eyes swiveled to the sorrowful girl who was currently cowering in the foyer, looking as fearful as a cornered hamster as she trembled and tried not to cry. I had to assume she understood English, so I shot her my best sympathetic look, but she just continued to shake. I looked around the room and tried desperately to remember everything Miranda had just rattled off. "Will do," I called in the general direction of her voice, past the baby grand piano and the 17 separate flower arrangements that had been lovingly placed around the house-size suite.
"I'll be back in just a moment with everything you've asked for."
I quietly berated myself for ending a sentence with a preposition and took one last look around the magnificent room. It was undoubtedly the plushest, most luxurious place I'd ever seen, with its brocade curtains, thick cream-colored carpeting, richly woven damask bedspread on the king-size bed, and gold-painted figurines tucked discreetly on mahogany shelves and tables. Only a flat-screen TV and a sleek silver stereo system gave any indication that the entire place hadn't been created and designed in the previous century by highly skilled craftsmen plying their trade. I ducked past the quaking maid and into the hallway. The terrified bellman had reappeared.
"Could you show me to my room, please?" I asked as kindly as I could, but he clearly thought that I would be abusing him as well, and so once again he scurried ahead of me.
"Here, mademoiselle, I hope this is acceptable."
About 20 yards down the hall was a door without a separate number on it. It opened to a mini-suite, nearly an exact replica of Miranda's, but with a smaller living room and a queen-size bed instead of a king. A large mahogany desk outfitted with a multi-line corporate-style phone, sleek desktop computer, laser printer, scanner, and fax machine had taken the place of the baby grand piano, but otherwise the rooms were remarkably similar in their rich, soothing decor.
"Miss, This door leads to the private hallway connecting your room and Miss Priestley's, he explained as he moved to open the door.
No, it's fine. I don't need to see it. Just knowing it's there is good enough,